Okay, our next presenter is Ian McCrae from the University of Minnesota, the Crookston Research and Outreach Center, and he's going to be talking to us today about remote sensing of Colorado potato beetle defoliation.
There's a pointer there. I don't need it.
Thanks, Bob. So how do you know when an elephant's borrowed your shoes? They're gone. That's not a very funny joke, but when I told it to my daughter and she was 6 years old, it killed. But it does underscore one of the points we're going to talk about. We've been talking about a lot about how you use remote sensing and cameras, especially multispectral, to sense and assess plant health and plant stress. But there's other things you can do with them. Now, we do a lot of that with insect, with the projects that we're working on. But as we were progressing and looking at some of the plant stress that we were looking at in potatoes, for example, with several of the different potato insects, it occurred to us that the real low-hanging fruit in that system for the use of UAS was defoliation. It's easy to tell when defoliation is occurring because the plants are gone. It's easy. Now, if you've got an insect like Colorado potato beetle, they defoliate, and they defoliate in a very serious way. Now, I don't know if a lot of you are familiar with CPB, with Colorado potato beetle, but isn't that a beautiful insect? Isn't that just lovely? For all you agronomists, this is confirmation of the fact that, yes, entomologists are farther off the center than you are. So you'll get, in Minnesota, they overwinter as adults. You'll have the adults popping out. They give rise to larvae, and these things are all very, very serious defoliators. And if you are late in treating Colorado potato beetle, you can see up to 50% or higher losses. And I'm not talking really late. I'm talking a week to 2 weeks late. If you let these things go, they will take a plant right down to the nub. I mean, all you have left is that. And that actually occurs. That's one of the control plots in our spray trials. So yeah, you can see the defoliation. Not hard. So heavy populations of these things really do defoliate. So as far as looking at defoliation is concerned, there's your model. It's great, wonderful system to work with as far as this is concerned. Okay, so when we do our plots, our insecticide trial plots, they're 4-row, so they're roughly about 4 meters wide and about 7.5 meters in length. Most of these are done on russet Burbank. This was an irrigated site, so we're just kind of setting up how these potatoes are going to grow. We kind of do them standard, just commercial production of potatoes. And we're using various insecticides. Now, Colorado potato beetle is a notoriously difficult insect to control with insecticides because they have a long history of developing resistance. In fact, it's the poster child for insecticide resistance. It's the one that's oftentimes used as an example, as kind of a worst-case scenario. So a lot of the insecticides that we use in our trials have really variable results, which is bad if you're thinking about using that insecticide for control, but is really good if you're looking for varying rates of defoliation across a research field. So when we were kind of doing our insecticide trials, we go out and we do ground-based assessments of defoliation. And it means that you've got to go out there. And this is exactly what you would do if you were a producer and you were relying on a foliar application and you were using a defoliation threshold. You'd go out, you'd cruise your field, you'd use some estimates at some sample locations, and you try to estimate based on your eye what the amount of plant material is missing. So you come up with some sort of an estimate, and it sounds very kind of hit and miss. There is some variability between people, but after you've been doing it for a long period of time, and you've got somebody had talked about, Jesse had mentioned minimum wage undergraduate slaves. I mean workers. You have actually fairly good estimates on the ground. You have a pretty good idea of what levels of defoliation are occurring out there. We were actually flying these fields about twice a week, once to twice a week, and kind of correlating our results with what our ground-based numbers were like. We have a tendency to use the same kind of material, the same kind of vehicles that Jesse was using, and in fact, much of the methods that he presented, we do too. We use modified digital cameras like the Sony NEXT, and as Dr. Boland had said, basically every digital camera out there is sensitive into the near IR, about 1100 nanometers, maybe a little less. If you remove the filter, that means that CCD chip in there is now sensitive to, or will record that near IR. It will see it and it will record it. Unfortunately, you've got three bands. You got red, green, and blue in a digital camera. So you've got to put a different filter in there because the near IR has to be channeled to one of those three bands. And this is one of the reasons why they actually filter the near IR out, because it makes pictures, you know, visible pictures, fuzzy, and because it's trying to occupy one of those bands. You can get purpose-built cameras like the TetraCam. That's a very early version. It's a large, heavy camera, and so we don't fly it on our iris. We do fly those 3D robotics irises. But we also have a much larger one, DJI S1000. This is an octocopter and has a much heavier payload. So we can lift the TetraCam and the Sony's and a number of other sensors simultaneously. The vehicle is stabilized so that if the a wind gust lifts it on one side, the vehicle will compensate. It slows rotors on one side, increases rotors on the other side, and the vehicle compensates. The technology that actually went into the original DJIs were the same thing that were in the Wii handhold controllers on those video games. That's what they were using. It's an attenuometer and an accelerometer kind of together. And so we also hang underneath the vehicle a gimbal, because if the vehicle is doing this, you want that camera to still be pointing straight down. So the gimbal is compensated as well as a separate system, and it will point down. There is a little bit of lag time, so you want to make sure that when you're doing something like this, you have overlap in your imagery and in your flight paths. But basically, very, very similar cameras to, you know, what you'd see being used in any other UAS application. When you do this, you fly over, you get individual images. All our flights are at about 40 meters. And we like to fly that low for a couple of reasons. One, it puts us below treetop level. Now, one of the big concerns, and Cassandra was talking about FAA regulations, one of my big personal concerns is smacking into another airplane, you know, something with a person in it. That's the 800-pound gorilla in the room. That's the one you really got to be concerned about. In production areas, a lot of ag aviation occurring, a lot of spray planes going around, especially if you're in an area that's doing potatoes because they're spraying weekly. So we fly below treetop level. If you get much above there, you stay in the same ferrying altitude where the guys are going back and forth between their base and the next field that they're going to spray in. So you want to stay out of that pathway. So you take individual images. We use exactly the same software. It's Agisoft. It's put out by a company in Russia. It's very good about linking stuff together, and that is not one image. That's a stitched result, a mosaic of all of those individual images. The software does an incredibly good job about stitching those together into basically one large image. And it looks like it's taken at a much higher altitude than it is, because you kind of are zooming out. We use GCPs as well, because as you can see, as you fly over the field, you have a moving image. And to link those together, the software looks for tie points, similar locations on the image. And so we give them to them. And we use these plates that all have unique markers on the top. We calculate out what the angle of vision is for the camera, and we make sure that those occur, the same one occurs over at least one or at least two images, and hopefully over three. So the ground control points really do help a lot in tying that stuff together into one image. Now, when you buy one of the multispectral cameras from a company, chances are it's going to come with proprietary analysis software. And undoubtedly, one of the things that it's going to have in it is some form of supervised classification. Now, that means that you can go in and you can train the software to recognize something, and it will start looking for similar reflective values. And indeed, I think this near IR image, this false color near IR image, comes from our TetraCam ADC. The proprietary software does indeed have that. I think their name for it is canopy segmentation. And basically, you take the area of you're interested in. We do all our counts and all of our work on those center two rows. You want to, you know, the outsides are really just border rows. So you highlight those areas. You start saying, okay, you start also highlighting areas that are not vegetation. You can see those red squares, those red areas. No vegetation in there. I'm interested in finding how much in that area there. I've delineated that. How much of that is non-vegetation? And the software will go through a process, usually based on the min-max red and near IR values, and it'll start differentiating that out. And it will provide you with an answer, how much non-vegetation is in there. If you delineate that area out, like I said, it'll give you that, and it says, oh, well, you know, your canopy coverage is the opposite of what's non-vegetation, so it's 83.3%. So we can anticipate there is above roughly a 17% defoliation rating. We can then compare that to our ground observed ratings, and we come up with a correlation of how accurate this version is as compared to the ground observed one. And when we did that, and this was on that TetraCam image, and this is an average for one of the weeks, we come up with they're significantly correlated. R-square is not as high as it might be, but then this is a very simplistic model. It's just looking straight down. It's not taking a lot of things into consideration, like plant geometry or attitude. And there are other ways of doing this. Now, this work was all done with a multispectral camera, so we were looking at near IR. But what occurred to me is a lot of people who are buying drones right now, a lot of the growers who are buying drones right now, may not have a near IR camera. They may be using just visible. And probably the most common one out there is a GoPro. So we started thinking about what can you actually do with just visible imagery. And there's a number of things you can do. You can, where we are, it's extremely flat. We have clay soils. We get flooding in the spring. You can check how well drained your field is. You can go out and fly it in the spring and see how much standing water you get. Another really popular use for it is this time of year, you can fly it to the far side of the field and see how many geese are there and whether it's worthwhile going over there to hunt. That actually came from one of my growers. But we also figured that defoliation was probably one of the ones we could do. So we started looking at developing a model to use visible data from a GoPro to estimate defoliation. So we were using we use a number of software, image analysis software programs, but for this one we were also using ARC, very similar to what Dr. Poland was using, and again this was going to be supervised training of the software. We flew weekly with the UAS, we did fly a visible GoPro. We used a Hero 3. The images were captured from the video using VLC Media Player. This creates a bunch of TIFF images. The TIFF images then can be stitched together as Agisoft, the same way that we would ordinarily do with that TetraCam. And you get something that looks like this. And again, it's visible imagery. It's not near IR. We don't have a lot of spectral reflect. We have no spectral reflectance in there. But you can start to see the defoliation in those failed plots and in the control plots right away. We still wanted to know how closely that comes up to a ground-based observation, because your defoliation thresholds are going to be based on actual numbers. And you can look at a plot and say, yeah, I've got defoliation there, I've got Colorado potato beetle there, but you're not sure what rate the defoliation is unless you're right down to the ground and it's extremely obvious. So we were interested in actually doing the analysis and seeing, can we calculate out the percent defoliation the same way we do with the near IR images. So we uploaded that stitched image into ArcGIS. We bounded the centers of the plot, so center two rows, with polygons, and then we kind of clipped the stitched image to produce a raster of just the plots that we were going to be analyzed out of that one large one. It was just going to have just the plots. Then we used supervised classification, which you can get in ARC now. I think it's been available since version 8, and the training data basically was obtained that represented both soil and vegetated areas. Again, we just highlighted the area and started looking for the appropriate areas. You end up with something that looks like this. The original stitched image is on the left, and on the right, if you look at just if it was completely black and just had the little pink boxes, that would be the clipped image of just the plot areas that we're interested in. That's what you apply the classification to. We use maximum likelihood classification. It's probably the most popular one that you can use for supervised classification. All the pixels were included in the classification. We didn't leave any out because of low probability. The resulting raster image should provide you then with the areas of vegetation and the areas of soil, and they should convert that into a polygon shapefile, and indeed they did. And then we do the same thing. The raster image is backlaid over the original layer, so we can start looking at associating the calculated defoliation with the image, the original plot numbers. And so it looks kind of like this when you've done the classification. The green would be defoliation, and the brown, or the green would be plant material. The brown is all non-vegetative plant material. Now, in this case, because we actually trained the software to recognize completely defoliated stalks as non-vegetation, because once that plant, once that potato plant gets stripped of all its leaves, it's going to die. You're not. Occasionally, you'll see some grow back, but that really depends on the time of the year. So there is some kind of, you do have to modify the model a little bit based on what the conditions of your growth are at the time. Earlier in the season, if you get stripped right down and all the leaves are gone, you may get a little bit of regrowth from the seed piece. But if it's later in the year, the seed piece is not going to reinitiate another stem. When we correlated that and looked at the model fit, it was a lot higher than what we were looking at for just the that kind of very oversimplified software that we were using for the previous one on the near IR. And in fact, most weeks have a correlation coefficient of about 0.89. Again, significant relationship. There is a little bit there's a few things that we're going to continue to do. We are working on calculating digital elevation models for this work to give a little bit more realistic image of what our resulting map is like, so that you have a better image of what that defoliation is. But what was really useful here was we were able to take the same techniques that we use to analyze plant stress, and we were able to apply them to just visible data. So even though we have the best results on evaluating plant stress, and for the most part, insect feeding with multispectral and hyperspectral data, we still can do a lot of work with just visible data. So there's a lot of actual opportunity for the use of these vehicles and this technology, and certainly in entomology. We have like any other project that involves UAS, you have a lot of people who are involved. We've been very fortunate in that one of the things that has moved our project forward a lot was one of the authors of the paper, Tim Baker. He's the lead technician on this project. He's actually a pilot, and so he speaks FAA, which is a foreign language, as Cassandra pointed out. And so it made it very, very easy to go forward. We have all our FAA certifications. We've got our COAs for basically all the research and outreach centers in Minnesota. That really eased the regulatory issues. We have tail numbers on all our vehicles. Those are hoops that you have to hop through if you're going to do this for research. We have, like I said, we have a lot of people to thank. We have a lot of people who are out there counting beetles. We have a lot of people who are out there analyzing images. So. All right, time for questions. At the back?
Yes. I know that Colorado potato fields often time are going to be starting commenting a field on the edge. And I know that potato fields can be pretty heterogeneous the way they're planted.
Yep.
Do you have any insights on how to differentiate bare ground due to defoliation versus just planting heterogeneity?
Well, that's actually a really good point, and it leads me to something I probably should have mentioned as well. If you're going to use defoliation this way to kind of trigger a threshold and trigger a treatment threshold, you really do need to do it over time, because you need to have an idea of how much how much foliage was there last week. You have to kind of anticipate what new material is coming on, and then kind of do a defoliation as a comparative one. Sparing that, you need to have what we basically have, and that's reference plots where you just have, you know, seed. You've got seed-treated material, you know, an at plant down. You're following up with weekly applications, and you're excluding all insects, so you've got a completely 0% defoliated plot. I don't think that's really possible if you're doing commercial production. So it's kind of an overtime thing, but that is a good example. Yeah, you are going to have to start training. You do have to train the software to look at what is bare soil, what is, and this is why we included those denuded, those completely defoliated plant stocks. We still counted that as non-vegetative material. So you do have to go through this. The nice thing about it is that those single images, even though you have this one large image, you actually have the ability to go somewhat back down to the original resolution of the image. And so with the TetraCam, it's only a 1.3 megapixel camera. The Sony, which is, or the Hero actually, takes up to, true HD, I believe. So you have the resolution to go in there and be very specific about how you're going to train the software. The nice thing is once you've got the model done, you can start applying it to other fields.